Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading today from the March 5th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing today, in the foreground, it's got one of those big green interstate road signs. It says, "Welcome to Texas." It's got a Texas flag, and on the bottom it says, "Where energy is deregulated." It's got icicles dripping from it. In the background is a frozen scene, and there's a barrel fire with a, looks like a family gathered around it. They're trying to stay warm. And the headline is, "Why Texans Froze: How the State's Unique Energy Policies Led to a Perfect Storm of Misery." And that's our first main story. We'll start right there. Texans freeze as power grid fails. What happened? Texans faced more than $20 billion in damage and a rising death toll this week after a winter storm overpowered the state's electrical grid and left millions without heat and electricity for days in temperatures that plunged into the single digits. Desperate residents huddled in beds and cars and burned furniture to stay alive. "It was 10 degrees. There's only so many covers you can use," said Tasha Henderson, an aunt of three kids in Houston. More than 60 deaths were reported from hypothermia, carbon monoxide poisoning, and other related causes, a number that authorities said was certain to grow. After most power was restored, residents still faced gasoline shortages, empty supermarket shelves, and the need to boil drinking water. Thousands faced extensive home damage from burst water pipes. "So many things have broken down on so many levels," said Chris Colvin, the director of medical center at Kylene, where workers couldn't flush toilets or wash their hands. Texas Governor Greg Abbott initially blamed the fiasco on frozen wind turbines and the Green New Deal. That claim was widely mocked, since in winter, Texas gets about 10% of its power from wind. The real culprit, energy experts say, was Texas' uniquely unregulated energy market, which doesn't require providers to winterize their systems or maintain a power reserve. Frigid temperatures froze natural gas wells and pipelines as well as wind turbines, and shut down a nuclear reactor after the water supply froze. Experts who'd long warned of such a crisis said the state's anti-regulation Republican leadership had reaped what it sowed. "They all chose cheap over reliable," said University of Houston energy economics professor Ed Herz, "and they got it." What the editorial said. As his constituents shivered, Abbott turned to political games, said the Houston Chronicle. The real problem was not wind turbines, but an unregulated system that maximizes profits and keeps prices low by failing to insure against a crisis like this one, a vulnerability he and other state officials had been warned of since a similar ice storm and blackouts in 2011. "Frozen windmills are not exclusively to blame," said the Washington Examiner, "but the vulnerability of green energy shouldn't be glossed over. President Biden and his administration are pointing to a utopian future where fossil fuels are replaced by windmills and rainbows. But the abrupt cut in wind power last week is a reminder that wind and solar can't be exclusively relied upon, and that the future of the progressives envision is a lot colder and darker than they admit. What the columnist said, this was a perfect free market storm of Republican incompetence, said Cliff Schechter in the DailyBeast.com. The needless death and suffering were a logical result of a free market fetish that has gripped the GOP since the Reagan era, leading to the 2008 meltdown of derivatives and banks, opposition to Obamacare and Medicaid, and the disastrous handling of the pandemic. 35 years after Reagan, the 9 most terrifying words in the English language may be, I'm a Republican politician and I run your government. Don't exaggerate, said Ryan Rusek in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Yes, the state was caught flat-footed by the unusually cold weather, and it's clear our power plants must be winterized. But as liberals loll in the warm bath of schadenfreude, let's remember that one awful week doesn't negate decades of prudent governance that have brought both people and businesses flocking to Texas from heavily regulated states like California. Cheap and abundant energy and low taxes have fueled growth that improves lives in ways no government program ever can. The Texas crisis carries a profound warning, said Christer Flavelle in the New York Times. It points to the risk posed by increasingly extreme weather to America's aging infrastructure. Prolonged heat waves, droughts, flooding, and Arctic cold snaps, all more likely because of climate change, are putting growing stress on drinking water systems, electrical grids, sewer systems, and mass transit. The past is no longer a safe guide for what lies ahead, said Alice Hill, a former risk assessor for the National Security Council. We are colliding with a future of extremes. Controversy of the week, Rush Limbaugh, how he changed conservatism. Conventional etiquette dictates that we do not speak ill of the dead, said Erin Gloria Ryan in the DailyBeast.com. But that never stopped Rush Limbaugh, who died of lung cancer last week at 70. After Kurt Cobain's suicide in 1994, the conservative talk radio pioneer called the young singer a worthless shred of human debris. At the peak of the AIDS epidemic, Limbaugh would mirthfully recite the names of the dead gay men while playing I'll Never Love This Way Again. He was no less cruel to the living. Women were sluts if they wanted publicly funded contraception, and castrating feminazis if they wanted careers, while the 12-year-old Chelsea Clinton was ugly, the White House dog. He once instructed a black caller to take that bone out of your nose and consistently described African Americans as lazy, crime-prone, ingrates, demanding redistribution of his listeners' money. Limbaugh's impact cannot be overstated, said Alex Shepard in NewRepublic.com, and that's not a compliment. The resentful, nativist, truth-disdaining, lib-owning culture of today's right was born and raised in Limbaugh's studio. He made America worse, and Donald Trump, inevitable. Liberals will never forgive Limbaugh, even in death, for breaking their monopoly on the national media, said Ben Shapiro in the New York Times. Before 1988, the conservative ecosystem amounted to a few niche magazines, a columnist or two, and the polysyllabic erudition of William F. Buckley, Jr.'s firing line. Limbaugh changed all that. He proved that even the driest tenets of conservative theory could be relayed in understandable language. His 20 million listeners found his funny, caustic, fighting spirit not just entertaining, but inspiring. Limbaugh showed that conservatism could be fun, said Dan McLaughlin in NationalReview.com. But as years passed and the nation's polarization deepened, Rush grew angrier, and there was more darkness and less light. Limbaugh wasn't funny, said Justin Peters in Slate.com. His wit was that of the prep school bully making fun of the foreign exchange student's lunch. He made himself wealthy by persuading his mostly white audience they were victims facing oppression and extinction from hordes of minorities, feminists, and liberal elites. In Obama's America, he once told his listeners, the white kids now get beat up with the black kids cheering. Like his fan and imitator Trump, Limbaugh was curiously devoid of any skill at argument, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Opposing points of view were dismissed not with logic and evidence, but by brute assertion, mockery, and resentment. His was the voice of the conservative id, paranoid and belligerent, and it came to dominate not only right-wing media, but the Republican Party itself. The line from Limbaugh to Trump is about an inch long. Limbaugh's talent for radio was real, said Charles Sykes in the Washington Post, and early on he led the conservative movement. By the end, Limbaugh was very much a follower, scrambling to keep up with his listeners as Trump led them ever deeper into the fear swamps and extremism and conspiracy theories. For conservatives, Limbaugh was a monkey's paw, bringing wish fulfillment at a terrible cost, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. He was a true pioneer who created a right-wing media infrastructure of enormous reach and energy. But over time, he replaced the gentlemanly conservative optimism of Buckley and Reagan with an insular, truth-denying cult of grievance that helped make conservatism less popular. His ultimately legacy is of ashes and defeat. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for the bespectacled, with a new study from India suggesting that people who wear glasses may be up to three times less likely to contract coronavirus. Researchers theorize that glasses prevent their wearers from rubbing their eyes with contaminated hands. It was a good week for grace. After Dolly Parton formally asked Tennessee lawmakers to shelve plans to erect a statue of her on the grounds of the state capitol. Given all that is going on in the world, I don't think putting me on a pedestal is appropriate at this time, tweeted the country legend, 75. She suggested the state wait until after I'm gone. And it was a good week for West Virginia, which is among the world and national leaders in COVID-19 vaccination rates, having administered 100% of the 436,000 doses it has received. Not bad for a bunch of hillbillies, said Major General James Hoyer, head of the state's vaccine task force. But it was a bad week for Mike Lindell, the MyPillow CEO, who declared himself so happy that Dominion voting system sued him for $1.3 billion. Lindell says his suit will enable him to prove his claim that Dominion's voting machines were rigged against Donald Trump. It was a bad week for the Breakfast of Champions, with news that customs inspections in Ohio intercepted a package containing 44 pounds of cornflakes frosted with cocaine instead of sugar. A narcotics detection dog named Biko sniffed out the creative smuggling effort. And finally, it was a bad week for line jumping after two women showed up at a Florida COVID vaccination site dressed as grannies with bonnets and spectacles so they could receive their second injections. When suspicious staff asked for ID, it turned out one woman was 34, the other 44. We're on the briefing page now. The forgotten nuclear threat. Constraints on nuclear proliferation have lapsed or been loosened in recent years. How great is the danger? Who has nuclear weapons? The vast majority, some 91% of the world's 13,400 nuclear weapons, are owned by the U.S. and Russia, which each have the power to render Earth an uninhabitable nuclear wasteland. The other early developers of nuclear arsenals were the UK, China, and France. In an attempt to prevent further spread, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, was adopted in 1970, pledging those five powers to eventually disarm in return for other states promising not to pursue the bomb. But more than 50 years later, all four of the countries that aren't party to the treaty, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea, have nuclear arsenals, although Israel has never confirmed it. And at least one signatory, Iran, has taken steps to build its own. Another treaty, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, just came into force in January. But none of the nuclear states signed it. The public concern about nuclear war has faded since countries became preoccupied with terrorism, climate change, and now viral pandemics. The threat remains very real. Potential triggers of nuclear conflict include India's border disputes with both Pakistan and China, Iran's threats to destroy Israel, Israel's pledge to prevent Iran from getting nukes, China's designs on Taiwan, and North Korea's threat to South Korea. What about arms control treaties? Few remain. During the Reagan era, the U.S. and Soviet Union agreed to slash their nuclear arsenals, but most arms control treaties since then have lapsed. The Bush administration pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2002, which sparked an arms race in missile defense systems. And President Trump yanked the U.S. out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty in 2019, saying that Russia had violated it. So the only remaining arms treaty the U.S. observes is the new START, a pact with Russia negotiated under the Obama administration. That treaty cut the number of deployed nuclear warheads that each side can have by more than half, to 1,550. Former President Trump was planning to let the treaty expire this month, but just after taking office, President Biden agreed with Russian President Vladimir Putin to extend the treaty for five more years. Biden will also try to revive the Iran nuclear deal. What is Iran's capability? Israeli intelligence says that the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist in November set Iran's nuclear program back, and that it would need 2 years to build a nuclear weapon. In the early 2000s, the International Atomic Energy Agency discovered that Iran had been cheating on the NPT with a clandestine program to enrich uranium. Under the 2015 treaty negotiated by the Obama administration, Iran agreed to radically slash its stockpile of uranium and limit the number of centrifuges that it can use for enrichment. But since the Trump administration pulled out of the deal in 2018 and hit Iran with new sanctions, Iran has resumed production of 20% enriched uranium, getting 9/10 of the way toward weapons-grade fuel. What happens if Iran goes nuclear? It would set off a chain of proliferation. Saudi Arabia, Iran's enemy, has said it would seek nukes if Iran got them, and Turkey and Egypt could follow. The threat from North Korea, meanwhile, is alarming to Japan and South Korea, where factions have argued for the development of their own nuclear weapons as deterrents. Since it first tested a nuclear weapon in 2006, North Korea has built dozens of bombs and hundreds of missiles, and it now has intercontinental ballistic missiles that can reach anywhere, including the continental United States. Our allies are now wondering, says Ivo Dalder of the Chicago Council of Global Affairs, will you sacrifice us for you? Will you save Seattle at the price of Seoul? The more nuclear weapons there are in the world, of course, the more likely it is that one could be fired by accident or fall into terrorist hands. What comes next? The next nuclear summit, the NPT review conference held every 5 years, takes place in August. That will be a chance for the Biden administration to reassure allies and to open negotiations with rising power China. China is planning to double its arsenal to 200 warheads over the next decade, and it has been pouring money into new missile designs. Admiral Charles Richard, head of the U.S. Strategic Command, says China will soon be a nuclear peer of the U.S., just as Russia is. For the first time ever, the U.S. is going to face two peer-capable nuclear competitors who are different, who you have to deter differently, he said. We have never faced that situation before. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start for two from the U.S. When will we be back to normal? The end of the pandemic is on the horizon at last, said Joe Binkster. But the question everyone is now asking, when does normal life return? The coronavirus variants have introduced some uncertainty, but as vaccine doses become available to all Americans and warm weather returns, summer could miraculously be close to normal. Most experts think that at some point after July 1, it will become safe to socialize with vaccinated friends and family indoors, to work in offices, to dine inside restaurants, and to travel domestically. But because of vaccine resistance here and slower vaccination abroad, indoor concerts, indoor sporting events, and full international travel will likely not yet resume. The fall could see some isolated flare-ups with the real risk that variants will set us back. But vaccines tweaked to defeat those variants could be rolled out in a matter of months. In coming years, the virus will still circulate throughout the world, similar to the flu, but with far fewer serious illnesses and deaths. By the spring of 2022, Americans should be able to do most, if not all, of the things they missed so much during 2020 and 2021, mask and worry-free. Biden's Afghanistan choices. President Biden faces an agonizing choice in Afghanistan, said David Ignatius. Eager to end U.S. troop presence abroad, President Trump agreed to a tentative peace deal with the Taliban to withdraw the remaining 2,500 U.S. troops by May 1. But the Kabul government, headed by President Ashraf Ghani, may be too corrupt and fragile to survive, and a total U.S. withdrawal will likely lead to its fall and a Taliban takeover. images of the fall of Kabul to celebrating Islamist extremists would embolden jihadists and re-energize a movement that's been in retreat, with Afghanistan once again becoming a safe haven for terrorists. A Taliban takeover would also lead to horrific violations of human rights, particularly for the Afghan girls and women who've enjoyed far more freedom since the religious extremist regime was toppled in 2001. If Biden decides to stay, it will trigger new Taliban attacks on our forces. The Pentagon may argue that the cost of keeping a small but sustainable force in Afghanistan is well worth it. But it will be Biden's burden to explain why the sacrifice is necessary and to write a letter of condolence to the family of the first American who dies on his watch in this terrible war. This column is from Brazil. Forgotten casualties of the pandemic. The pandemic has hit Brazil's black domestic workers the hardest, said Clara Azuncal, and the government is doing almost nothing to help. The very first COVID-19 fatality in Rio de Janeiro was a 63-year-old black maid, Cleonice Goncalves, who died in March after her wealthy employer returned from Italy, where the virus was already widespread. Since they work in people's homes, maids are at particular risk of infection. Many have complained that their employers refuse to wear masks or maintain social distance. But President Jair Bolsonaro's right-wing government hasn't included them on the list of those to be vaccinated first. Even as truckers, who make up a far less of the population and work largely solo, get priority. Of course, many maids are no longer employed at all. Since the pandemic began, more than 1.5 million domestic workers, of whom more than 90% are women and more than two-thirds are black, have been laid off. About the same number of people have lost jobs in the tourism industry. Yet while the government has offered that sector a generous bailout, it did nothing for the sacked maids. Bolsonaro's neglect of domestic workers is an example of our endemic racism and a stain on Brazilian society. A heavy title for our in-depth article this week, The Last Word. Half a million Americans are gone. As the U.S. reaches a terrible COVID-19 milestone, said Julie Bosman in the New York Times, Americans cope with the emptiness left by so much debt. A nation numbed by misery and loss is confronting a number that still has the power to shock. 500,000. Roughly 1 year since the first known death by the coronavirus in the United States, we have hit an unfathomable toll, the loss of 500,000 people. No other country has counted so many deaths in the pandemic. More Americans have perished from COVID-19 than on the battlefields of World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined. The milestone comes at a hopeful moment. New virus cases are down sharply, deaths are slowing, and vaccines are steadily being administered. But there is concern about emerging variants of the virus, and it may be months before the pandemic is contained. Each death has left untold numbers of mourners, a ripple effect of loss that has swept over towns and cities. Each death has left an empty space in communities across America, a bar stool where a regular used to sit, one side of a bed unslept in, a home kitchen without its cook. The living find themselves amid vacant places once occupied by their spouses, parents, neighbors, and friends. The 500,000 coronavirus dead. In Chicago, the Reverend Ezra Jones stands at his pulpit on Sundays, letting his eyes wander to the back row. That spot belonged to Moses Jones, his uncle, who liked to drive to church in his green Chevy Malibu, arrive early and chat everybody up before settling into his seat by the door. He died of the coronavirus in April. "I can still see him there," said Jones, the pastor. "It never goes away." There's a street corner in Plano, Texas, that was occupied by Bob Manis, a veteran crossing guard who shepherded children to school for 16 years until he fell ill in December. In the Twin Cities of Minnesota, Lee Hong Burdick, 72, another victim of the coronavirus, is missing from the groups she cherished. One for playing bridge, another for mahjong, and another for polishing her English. At her empty townhouse, the holiday decorations are still up. There are cards lined up on the mantel. "You walk in and it smells like her," said her son, Keith Bartram. Seeing the chair she would sit in, the random things around the house, it's definitely surreal. "I went over there yesterday and had a little bit of a breakdown. It's hard to be in there when it looks like she should be there, but she's not." The virus has reached every corner of America, devastating dense cities and rural counties alike. By now, about 1 in 670 Americans has died of it. In New York City, more than 28,000 people have died of the virus, or 1 in 295 people. In Los Angeles County, which has lost nearly 20,000 people to COVID-19, about 1 in 500 people has died of the virus. In Lamb County, Texas, where 13,000 people live scattered on sprawling expanse of 1,000 square miles, 1 in 163 people has died of the virus. Across America, the holes in communities, punctured by sudden death, have remained. In Anaheim, California, Monica Alvarez looks at the kitchen in the house she shared with her parents and thinks of her father, Jose Roberto Alvarez. Jose Alvarez, 67, a maintenance supervisor, worked the overnight shift until he died from the virus in July. Before he got sick, he would come home from his usual workday and prepare an early morning meal. Monica, beginning her workday as an accountant from her computer in the nearby dining room, would chat with him while he scrambled a plate of eggs. "With his passing, we've rearranged some rooms in the house," she said. "I don't work in the dining room anymore. I'm glad for that. I'm sad, but I'm glad. It's a reminder being there." 1 year ago, as the coronavirus took hold in the United States, few public health experts predicted its death toll would climb to such a terrible height. At a White House briefing March 31st, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top infectious disease expert in the country, and Dr. Deborah Birx, who was coordinating the coronavirus response at the time, announced a stunning projection. Even with strict stay-at-home orders, the virus might kill as many as 240,000 Americans. As sobering a number as that is, we should be prepared for it, Fauci said at the time. Less than a year later, the virus has killed more than twice that number. The virus has disproportionately caused the deaths of Americans in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities, where infections spread easily among vulnerable residents. They account for more than 163,000 deaths, about one-third of the country's total. In New Hampshire, 73% of COVID-19 deaths were linked to nursing homes through last week. In Minnesota, it was 62%. The coronavirus has been especially lethal to Americans 65 and older, who account for about 81% of the country's COVID-19 deaths. One of them was a man nearly everyone called Mr. Bob. Bob Manna, 79, was an unmistakable presence on the corner of Clark and Yeary in Plano, Texas. There was his black whistle hanging around his neck on a lanyard, sharp, shrill, and authoritative. A neon vest that he wore as part of his safety uniform. In his careful way with the children, he guided across the street each morning and afternoon. He knew the family. He knew their dogs, said Ann Lynn, who lives nearby and walks her children to school. After Manis died of coronavirus in January, the block changed, she said. There's a noticeable difference now. It's this heaviness, and it's a reminder of what COVID took. A group of parents has planned an honorary plaque to be erected at the spot where Manis worked. My kids were devastated, said Sarah Cassell, the PTA president. They went from seeing him every day to him never coming back. Manis has not yet been replaced. For now, his corner sits empty. Ignacio Silverio and his sister, Leticia Silverio, used to have a ritual. They would meet and chat over coffee in her restaurant, Shelley's, which she opened in their hometown, Redlands, California, 4 years ago. Ignacio still comes by the restaurant, but now his sister is gone after dying from the coronavirus in August at the age of 40. Her husband has kept the restaurant operating, a main source of income. Other family members have pitched in to help. When I go inside, it's a surreal moment, and there's always this hope, Ignacio says. You know, maybe it's all a dream, and she would greet me, and we would sit down together and drink coffee. Some families have moved away from the places that are so painfully entwined with memories. In April, Carly Greer picked up her father, Michael Horton, 66, from the hospital where he had been battling the coronavirus. The doctor said he was ready to continue his recovery at home, and Greer had him stay with her family, setting him up in a bed in her daughter's room. 4 days later, he died there, without warning. Even now, 10 months after her father's death, Greer remains haunted by the space. Every time I walk into my daughter's room, it's like I see him there, she said. I see him around the whole house. I can't stand to be there. On Friday, the family moved out, hoping that a new home would bring new memories. The feeling of loss throughout the United States goes beyond physical spaces. People are feeling a psychological and spiritual void, said Patty Lynch, a funeral director in Michigan who has worked with families who have lost relatives to the coronavirus. Part of that void, he said, comes from the missing rituals, the lack of communal catharsis after a death. Aldine Sands, 90, once a stay-at-home mother who raised 5 children in Illinois, died in December while living in a nursing home that was ravaged by the virus. Her funeral service was kept small, an effort to make sure the gathering was safe. It was sad and so strange, said her daughter Becky Milstead. Only 9 people were there. As the United States reaches 500,000 deaths from the coronavirus, there are few events in history that adequately compare. The 1918 influenza pandemic is estimated to have killed about 675,000 Americans, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, when the country's population was one-third of what it is now. but it also happened at a time when influenza vaccines, antibiotics, mechanical ventilation, and other medical tools did not exist yet. Drew Kilpenfaust, a historian, former president of the Harvard University, said medical and societal achievements in the United States had caused many Americans to believe we were ready for anything, that we had conquered nature. When there were field hospitals in Central Park, the bodies piled up because there was no capacity to bury them. We were just so shocked at ourselves and had not thought that this would ever happen to us, said Faust, whose book, The Republic of Suffering, explores how Americans grappled with the death after the Civil War. That sense of mastery over nature has been so seriously challenged by this pandemic. Deaths from COVID-19 in the United States came faster as the pandemic went on. The first known death occurred in February 2020, and by May 27th, 100,000 people had died. It took 4 months for the nation to log another 100,000 deaths. The next, about 3 months. The next, just 5 weeks. Although daily deaths are now slowing, about 2,000 deaths in America are being reported each day. As of early this week, the toll had reached 502,419. This will be a sad day in our history, said Dr. Ali Mukad, a public health researcher at the University of Washington. Our grandchildren and future generations will look back at us and blame us for the biggest failure in facing a pandemic in the country that's the richest country in the world, that we allowed people to die, that we didn't protect our vulnerable populations, Native American, Hispanic, and African American, that we did not protect our essential workers. It will still take months to vaccinate the American public, and new, more contagious variants of the virus could quickly undo the nation's progress and lead to another spike. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation and Independent Global Health Research Center at the University of Washington has projected that the nation could reach more than 614,000 deaths by June 1. Factors like how well people adhere to guidelines like mask wearing and social distancing, plus the speed of vaccinations, could affect that estimate. Mark Buchanan, manager at the Side Door Saloon in Petoskey, Michigan, has been thinking of the stool where his friend Larry Cummings, a professor, used to sit on Monday nights for a chat, some football, and a glass of ice water. It was like 9:10 every Monday, Buchanan said. We knew that when the door opened, it was Larry walking in. Cummings' widow, Shannon, said she had tried to take comfort in knowing that her husband, who died of COVID-19 in March at the age of 76, had a full, meaningful life, rich with family, friends, and travel. But ever since he died, she has been sleeping on his side of the bed. By doing so, this space isn't empty, she said. She recently cleaned out her husband's university office and sifted through everything he had tucked away there, a collection of political buttons, handwritten cards from their daughters, and a file of papers from an extended trip they were supposed to take to the Balkans last summer. This month, she finally sold his car, a Volvo sedan that had been sitting unused for much of the past year. I didn't realize how hard it would be to sell it, she said. It hit me in a way that surprised me, shocked me. It was admitting that he's really not there. A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. We're on the health and science page. A couple of short pieces, starting with Perseverance begins its search for life. After a nearly 7-month, 293 million mile journey, with a heart-stopping final descent, NASA's Perseverance rover safely landed on Mars last week to begin a new search for signs of past Martian life. The $2.7 billion car-sized Explorer is fitted with an array of sophisticated equipment, including cameras, lasers, and ground-penetrating radar that scientists hope will find chemical evidence of fossilized microbial life. Project scientist Ken Farley tells the Washington Post that the mission, the most ambitious yet of NASA's 20 trips to the Red Planet, will really make the first step in answering the question of whether life exists elsewhere. If there is proof that microbes arose on Mars billions of years ago when it was warmer and wetter, it will strongly suggest that we are not alone in the universe. The vehicle carrying Perseverance entered the Martian atmosphere at 12,000 miles per hour and decelerated using a 70-foot diameter parachute and rocket thrusters. Then a sky crane lowered the rover into the Jezero crater, the site of an ancient Martian lake. Because of the 11-minute signal delay between Earth and Mars, the whole process was autonomous. After some equipment test, Perseverance will attempt a first, launching a tiny solar-powered helicopter, Ingenuity, into the thin Martian atmosphere. The rover will then trundle over the old lake's delta to begin its search in earnest. A drug to fight obesity. And what scientists say is a game changer for obesity, an appetite-suppressing drug has helped people lose up to 20% of their body weight. The treatment, semaglutide, is already used for type 2 diabetes. It is a synthetic version of GLP-1, a naturally occurring hormone released by the body after a filling meal. In a new trial involving 2,000 people in 16 countries, scientists administered a much higher dose of semaglutide to people wanting to lose weight. Over 15 months, the participants who received the drug lost an average of almost 15% of their body weight, compared with only 2.4% of those who got a placebo. Almost a third of recipients lost 20% of their weight. Those who lost weight also saw substantial reductions in risk factors for heart disease and diabetes, such as high blood pressure and blood sugar levels. Lead author Robert Kushner from Northwestern University tells the New York Times their findings mark the start of a new era of effective treatments for obesity. And we'll turn over to the Talking Points page. Start with an article called Flying Ted, A Gaffe for the Ages. In Washington, there is near universal agreement that nobody likes Ted Cruz, said Dan Zak in the Washington Post. But the loathing of the Texas Republican hit new heights this week after he flew off to the Cancun Ritz-Carlton while more than a million of his ice-blasted constituents were sitting in blacked-out, frozen homes, watching their pipes burst, boiling water to drink, and defecating in buckets. After being photographed at the airport on the way to 80-degree Mexico with his wife and two daughters, Cruz was shamed into lugging his bulging suitcase back to Houston 3 days earlier than planned. He had the gall to blame his daughters, saying they had begged for the trip, but leaked group texts showing Cruz's wife whining to friends that she was freezing and saying that she'd found a Cancun hotel room for just $309 a night. Nero fiddled while Rome burned, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com, and Ted Cruz jetted to Cancun. Cruz's biggest sin was not the hypocrisy of a faux good old boy populist abandoning his constituents. It's that he couldn't think of any way he could use his power as a U.S. senator to help Texans in need. Yes, Cruz is a spineless hack who voted to overturn the election in favor of the guy who once called his wife ugly, said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com. But he isn't stupid. The Princeton and Harvard-educated Cruz, 50, was expected to make another presidential run in 2024. So what was he thinking when he booked a getaway to sunny Mexico while his constituents froze in the dark? Look at what two of his fiercest Democratic rivals managed to do, said Amanda Carpenter in TheBulwark.com. Beto O'Rourke, whom Cruz narrowly defeated in 2018, organized a massive phone bank to check on Texas seniors, see if they needed help, and direct them to resources. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democrat from New York, went to Texas and helped raise $2 million for people in need. But Cruz not only fed our frozen hell, said the Houston Chronicle in an editorial, he ignored federal guidelines and took his family to Mexico, a level 4 coronavirus hotspot. Now his kids have to quarantine and miss class. It was obviously a mistake, he conceded upon his forced return. You think? Take our advice, Senator, and resign. Iran, is a new deal possible? President Biden has made his opening gambit to restart the Iran nuclear deal, said Alex Ward in Vox.com. Last week, he withdrew a request the Trump administration had made to the United Nations to reimpose sanctions on Iran because it was no longer in compliance with the 2015 accord signed by the U.S. and five other nations. The Biden team then jumped on an idea from a European diplomat to host an informal meeting of all parties to discuss the way forward. So far, however, Iran has said it will not begin any talks until the U.S. first lifts all sanctions former President Trump imposed as a part of his maximum pressure campaign. Iran also handed Biden his first credibility test, said Michael Knights in Politico.com. An Iranian-backed militia is believed to have fired about 24 rockets at a U.S. airbase in Iraq last week, killing one non-American contractor and wounding 9 other people. Biden must put Tehran on notice that if any American is killed or wounded by Iran's proxies, no negotiations will occur. Biden hasn't given away the store just yet, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But this week wasn't encouraging. After the rocket attack, the administration responded with a major concession on sanctions that will allow Iran to buy advanced weaponry. Such foolhardy forbearance will lead Tehran to reasonably think that Biden is so eager for talks that he'll ignore attacks on Americans. It's a shame that Biden seems hell-bent on reviving the deal, said New York Post in an editorial. The Iranians said last week that they will no longer allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to perform snap inspections of their nuclear sites, where there are enriching uranium to a suspicious level. Why negotiate with this untrustworthy terrorist state? Reviving the Iran deal will require tough, imaginative, and potentially painful diplomacy, said Robin Wright in The New Yorker, and even then it may be impossible. Iranians are indignant that they agreed to surrender most of their uranium and centrifuges and allow intrusive inspections, only to have President Trump unilaterally pull the U.S. out of the deal and hit Iran with sanctions that it says have cost them $250 billion. Feeling betrayed and distrustful, the Iranians insist the onus is on the U.S. to lift those sanctions. Meanwhile, Iran comes closer every day to the breakout time to produce and then assemble elements for a bomb. And a few short pieces here. We start with the pandemic cut U.S. life expectancy by a year to 77.8 in the first half of 2020, the largest drop since World War II. People of color saw the biggest impact, with blacks losing nearly 3 years and Hispanics losing nearly two. This is a huge decline, said CDC official Robert Anderson. The more than 500,000 Americans who've died of COVID-19 exceeds the number of war veterans buried in Arlington National Cemetery. The cemetery dates to the Civil War and holds the remains of troops from every major U.S. military conflict. Six Capitol Police officers have been suspended for their actions in the January 6th insurrection, and 29 others are under investigation. Those under suspicion include an officer who took a selfie with a member of the mob and one who wore a MAGA hat and directed invaders around the building. We'll finish out today with a quote from Kurt Vonnegut, quoted in Forbes.com, who says, "History is merely a list of surprises. It can only prepare us to be surprised yet again." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be reached at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138. And we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.